Welcome back to another episode of the Ninja Nerd Podcast. Today we're finishing our short series on autonomic pharmacology. Today we're finishing it up with our discussion on muscarinic antagonists. It's going to be a good one. Zach, you excited?
Oh, yeah.
Always excited, baby. As always, Ninja Nerds, don't forget, please go on to ninjanerd.org. Remember to grab your subscription to a 3-month, 6-month, a 1-year membership subscription. You can grab your notes and illustrations and really buckle down for this topic. But otherwise, if you're ready to go, we're ready to go. So we have to first start kind of like we've been doing if you've been following our short series here on the autonomic pharmacology. We're first going to lay down some foundation here. We're going to talk about the cholinergic physiology. We have to understand how and where acetylcholine is released, what receptors and organs that it will actually act upon, and then kind of understand that information first prior to moving into talking about any drugs. So Zach, go ahead and take it away.
All right. So when we talk about the cholinergic physiology, obviously there's various different neurons that can release acetylcholine. The ones that are pertinent to this discussion, again, I think is important to remember is that you have somatic neurons that release acetylcholine. When they release it that's primarily affecting the nicotinic receptors on the skeletal muscle, right? And so that's involved in voluntary motor movement. I think it's important to realize that there's also other receptors that are basically whenever acetylcholine is being released from these neurons, it binds onto muscarinic receptors. And this is generally for the parasympathetic nervous system. So your parasympathetic nervous system has neurons that release acetylcholine. They bind onto muscarinic receptors that produce a target organ effect. And these muscarinic receptors, instead of being found on skeletal muscle, they're found on smooth muscle, cardiac tissue in general, as well as glands. So let's talk about some of the pertinent areas of the body where we'll find these muscarinic receptors, and then we'll talk about the type of muscarinic receptor. So the central nervous system has various different types of muscarinic receptors. I think the important thing to remember for these is that they can be like, you can have muscarinic 1 receptors, you can have muscarinic type 4 receptors, muscarinic type 5 receptors. There's so many different types, but I think the big thing to remember for the central nervous system is that there's the muscarinic receptors present in the basal ganglia, and so they help to be able to modulate your motor movement. And then there's also these muscarinic receptors present on the emetic center present within the medulla that controls our vomiting reflex. So if a patient has a lot of acetylcholine that's being released, what it'll do is it could actually bind onto these muscarinic receptors within the basal ganglia and cause tremors and rigidity, or it could bind onto the muscarinic receptors present in the vomiting center and trigger a lot of vomiting. In the eyes, there's also muscarinic receptors, particularly on the pupils. There's muscarinic type 3 receptors, and they generally cause pupil constriction. And so that's important for, again, vision changes, particularly like close or near vision. But it also kind of like opens up that sclerovenous sinus or the canal Schlemm, which helps to improve venous drainage. The other thing is that there's a lot of muscarinic 3 receptors present on the lacrimal glands that produce, tears, and as well as the salivary glands that produce saliva. So important to remember that whenever they bind there, they'll increase secretions. On the heart, there's muscarinic type 2 receptors. And particularly what this will lead to is it'll lead to a decreased conduction through the AV node. And that'll actually lead to a decrease in the heart rate, which may also drop subsequently the cardiac output. The lungs have muscarinic type 3 receptors, which actually, when they're stimulated by acetylcholine, cause bronchoconstriction. The liver has some degree of muscarinic 3 receptors, which helps to be able to stimulate the secretion of bile, which helps to be able to aid in digestion. Not as an important of a one that I want you guys to remember, but I'm just adding it in there. And then the actual bladder has a lot of muscarinic 3 receptors. And so whenever acetylcholine binds on that, it causes very powerful bladder contractions. And then the GIT has a lot of smooth muscle there. So when muscarinic 3 receptors are present on that, it also will cause an increased GI motility. And then the skin, it actually does play a slight role within sweating. So that's an important kind of concept to understand. So there is acetylcholine that's present in the CNS. It helps with modulating movement. It helps with vomiting reflexes. It causes pupillary constriction via the M3 receptors. It causes lacrimal salivary gland secretion via the M3 receptors. It decreases heart rate via the M2 receptors. Bronchoconstriction via M3 receptors, bladder contraction and GI motility increased via the M3 receptors, and it can increase the sweating via an interesting type of reaction. So generally your sympathetic nervous system is involved in sweating, but what happens is the postganglionic motor neurons of the sympathetic nervous system that innervate sweat glands release acetylcholine. It's one of those exceptions to that system, but it does help to promote sweating. So that covers the basic physiology, Rob, that I think is really essential to cholinergic system, really the release of acetylcholine, the muscarinic receptors that are basically responsible for the target organ response. And I think that leads us into the next kind of discussion.
Absolutely. We're going to head right into this next segment now. Finally, the good stuff. We're going to talk about some drugs. So we got some good drugs coming up here. We have to talk about different types of muscarinic antagonists, categories of drugs, and really where are they affecting it within this cholinergic system, or really the parasympathetic nervous system.
Absolutely. So when we talk about muscarinic antagonists, what I want you to think about is there's two types. One is there's tertiary amines. Tertiary amines means that they're very lipophilic. They have the ability to be able to cross the blood-brain barrier. So they have good CNS penetration. So meaning if you give these drugs, they can affect different parts of your central nervous system, especially that basal ganglia system, especially the emetic center and the medulla. So that's very important. So we'll get to that. But one of these drugs that's a very commonly utilized muscarinic antagonist is called atropine. So atropine can work on the eye, can work on your glands, it can work on your heart, it can work on your bladder, it can do a lot of stuff. So it's a pretty interesting drug. So when it works in the eye, again, you're going to basically oppose all the physiological functions here. So if it's an antagonist, it opposes it. So generally, the pupils are going to constrict for the eye. So what would it do here? Pupillary dilation. And that's kind of a helpful kind of concept if you're trying to be able to kind of get a little bit of a better look at the eye, especially in situations when you need to kind of open that eye up and take a better look at it. But only downside of kind of using this particular drug is that when you give these drugs to be able to cause pupillary dilation, you actually kind of bunch up the base of the pupil, and that actually can kind of like compress that canal of Schlemm or the sclerovenous sinus. And so it impedes the actual drainage of aqueous humor, which can slightly worsen your intraocular pressure. So I'd be very, very careful and really kind of be avoiding these drugs in patients who have narrow angle glaucoma. You can definitely worsen their intraocular pressure. So be careful with that one, but it could be used as a pupillary dilating tool if you need to get a better look at the eyes, but don't use it if they have narrow angle glaucoma. Glands. So I sometimes will use this drug, especially in patients who, you know, I'm trying to avoid intubating, or they're perioperative and they just have a lot of secretions, a lot of oral secretions that maybe they can't manage properly. If I want to reduce some of the oral secretions that they could be potentially aspirating, I could give them something called atropine, and atropine will actually block those muscarinic 3 receptors that are present on your salivary glands and inhibit your salivation process. And so that'll kind of dry up the secretions. It can cause a dry mouth, unfortunately, but it may be useful in patients who are pre-intubation or pre-operative that you're trying to just clear some of those oral secretions. On the heart, it does act on the M2 receptor. So M2 receptors, usually, again, when you hit those, you want to drop the heart rate. And so if patients are extremely symptomatic bradycardia, their heart rate's like 10 and they're dropping their pressure and they aren't mentating anymore, that's a potential to utilize this drug as a quick 0.4 milligram bolus. And it might be able to, again, hit those muscarinic receptors, block the parasympathetic effect there. And then if you're blocking the actual AV node conduction, you're not allowing for AV node conduction, you might speed up the heart rate a little bit. So that's usually one of those first line drugs for symptomatic or acute bradycardia. For the bladder, I wouldn't say it's super powerful, but it does have the ability to block the M3 receptors in the bladder, and therefore you wouldn't have as powerful a urinary contraction. So it may lead to urine retention. And so sometimes we can use this as a drug in like a lot of urinary incontinence or urgency, but it's not the most common drug. We'll talk about ones that we could use that are a little bit better a little bit later. The other thing I would think about here is, especially with atropine, is it can be used in a cholinergic crisis. So if you guys remember, we just talked about this. If a patient is taking pyridostigmine, or they're taking neostigmine, or they're taking some type of physostigmine, and maybe they take too much and they end up in a cholinergic crisis and their heart rate is, you know, inappropriate in that situation, they're having some of the cholinergic crisis effects that we discussed, you can use atropine. And atropine may be potentially beneficial, especially especially for the heart rate, because in patients with a cholinergic crisis, they can become extremely bradycardic. And so you could potentially give them atropine to reverse some of the bradycardia, as well as some of the other effects like on the eye, on some of the glands, on the bladder. So you may see some potential benefit to that drug. All right. Another drug is called cyclopentolate. We can also use this one. It's a lot better on the eye than atropine. So it will cause a pretty profound pupillary dilation. So that could be used for certain types of eye exams if you really want to get that pupil open and take a better look at the retina. Just be careful. Again, acute angle glaucoma, if you kind of cause that pupil to dilate, it bunches up the base of the pupil and compresses on the sclerovenous sinus. So it doesn't drain as well. Another drug is called scopolamine. So scopolamine is really cool because I do like giving this one. I like giving it as a patch. And so sometimes I find this to be beneficial postoperatively, or patients who have a lot of vomiting or nausea, or motion sickness is another one. Patients who, you know, getting ready to go on a boat and they're just prone to a lot of motion sickness. What I'll do is I'll give scopolamine, because scopolamine, what it does is it actually hits the muscarinic receptors that are present on the emetic center in the medulla. Remember, I told you that there is muscarinic receptors type. Generally, there's like M1. There is like M4, M5 receptors present there. There's a lot of different receptors there. But if I give scopolamine, what it's going to do is it's going to block the muscarinic receptor on the emetic center in the medulla and reduce the vomiting urge, which may be beneficial in patients who are postoperatively coming out of anesthesia. The anesthesia causes some nausea. Some opioids can cause nausea. Pain can cause nausea. Or it could be some type of vertigo or vestibular dysfunction from motion sickness. So that's a pretty decent drug there. Again, that shows the CNS penetration with this drug. Okay, so that's why it's a tertiary kind of a meme. But we go to the next one, which also is a tertiary meme, and again, has very good central nervous system penetration. This is called bentropine and trihexyphenidyl. So what these do is they bind to the muscarinic receptors that are present on the basal ganglia. So you know, in patients who have Parkinson's disease, they develop kind of an imbalance. They develop a drop in their dopamine, a relative increase in their acetylcholine, which increases the risk of tremors and rigidity. So we can give bentropine and trihexyphenidyl to try to help to be able to restore the balance between dopamine and acetylcholine by blocking some of the relative excess of acetylcholine that's present in the basal ganglia. And so that may help to be able to reduce the tremors, the rigidity present in Parkinson's disease. And we also use that in patients who develop extrapyramidal symptoms in certain types of drugs, especially the common antipsychotics. All right. That's bentropine, trihexyphenidyl. The next couple drugs, which I told you are really a lot better at the bladder than atropine, is oxybutynin, tolterenine, and sulfenacin. So these are really, really good M3 blockers on the bladder. And so if they block the M3 receptors in the bladder, they decrease the very profound bladder contractions in patients who have overactive bladders or urinary kind of incontinent issues, and so who are having difficulty with frequency. Those kinds of effects, you're going to be able to kind of prevent that from kind of happening. So I do think these are pretty beneficial drugs. The next one I kind of squeezed in there because we talked a lot about the glands. We talked about the pupil. We talked about the heart. We talked about the central nervous system. But we didn't really talk about the GIT. And so these are other drugs that do have M3 blocking effect that are present on the GIT. And this is called dicyclamine and hyoscyamine. You can use this to decrease some of the GIT contraction. And that may be beneficial in patients who are having a lot of spasmodic type of contractility, especially in IBS, or they're having a lot of diarrhea. So I find that to be sometimes beneficial, more commonly utilized in patients who have IBS. Especially IBSD, so irritable bowel syndrome type D with a lot of the spasms that they can experience. So nice beneficial drug in that patient population. But that covers the tertiary means. So we talked about atropine, and that one, its profound effect primarily on the heart, but we also did talk about in the pupil, the salivary glands, and minor effect on the bladder. The better ones on the bladder is oxybutynin, tolterenine, sulfenacin. The other one that's better on the eye is cyclopentolate, which is going to cause pupillary dilation. The ones that are also good CNS penetration is scopolamine, blocks the emetic center in the medulla, prevents vomiting. And the other one that good CNS penetration that hits the basal ganglia structures is bentropine and trihexyphenidyl in Parkinson's disease, as well as in EPS symptoms from antipsychotics. And then dicyclamine and hyoscyamine as good GIT smooth muscle blockers as well. All right. We now go into the last category, which is your quaternary amines. They have poor CNS penetration. They're very hydrophilic, not able to cross that blood-brain barrier very well. There's two drug categories here that I want you to remember. One is called glycopyrrolate. I find this one to be somewhat beneficial as well, especially in comparison to atropine. So remember I told you that atropine can work on those like lacrimal glands and salivary glands to decrease salivation. I find in patients who, again, it might be beneficial pre-intubation, perioperative kind of states where they're having difficulty clearing their oral secretions. But another patient population I find glycopyrrolate to be somewhat beneficial in is patients who have a cerebral palsy or have difficulty like what's called sialorrhea. So they have excessive amounts of oral secretions, which is pretty common in the cerebral palsy population as well as other populations as well. So you're going to see this a lot, maybe more utilized in the pediatric population. But if they have just this excessive sialorrhea, excessive secretions, oral secretions, they're drooling all the time, I find this to be somewhat of a beneficial drug in that patient population, especially glycopyrrolate. So consider that one as well. And again, it's blocking the lacrimal glands and salivary glands, so it'll dry those out. The next drug category of the quaternary amines is the ones that are working on the bronchial system. So we've talked a lot about the CNS. We talked about the pupil. We talked about the heart. We talked about the GIT, the bladder. We talked about a lot of those. And now I think the last one is just thinking about the lungs. So there's bronchial smooth muscle present within the bronchioles, and they have a lot of M3 receptors. And there is drugs that love to bind to these and block them. And this is called ipratropium, which is a short-acting drug, and tiotropium, which is a long-acting drug. And so what they do is they block the M3 receptors present on the bronchial smooth muscle. And so naturally, those cause bronchoconstriction. If you block that effect, it's going to cause bronchodilation. And so that's a very beneficial thing in patients who have bronchospastic airway disease, especially asthma. And I also find even a little bit more like in patients who have COPD. So COPD, asthma, other types of obstructive lung diseases where there's a lot of bronchospasm within the airway, this may be beneficial drugs. Ipratropium, again, remember, more of a short-acting drug, so good in kind of acute situations, whereas tiotropium is more long-acting, so it's going to be more of a chronic medication for COPD or asthma patients. So that's an important thing to remember. And that kind of finishes off really the muscarinic antagonist, talking about, again, the two kind of groups of that, the tertiary amines, which are the good CNS penetration that includes atropine, cyclopentolate, scopolamine, benztropine, trihexyphenidyl, oxybutynin, tolteridine, sulfenacin, dicyclamine, and hyoscyamine. And then finally, the quaternary means poor CNS penetration, glycopyrrolate, and then ipratropium and tiotropium. So that kind of covers that, Rob, in that category.
Alrighty. Well, that leaves us with one thing left to talk about then. Really important adverse effects of some of these drugs. And really important, even the biggest one, is anticholinergic toxicity, which Zach will be certainly shedding some light on. So let's get right into that, Zach.
Yeah, so I think when we talk about anticholinergic toxicity, just in the same kind of capacity that we discussed with cholinergic toxicity, if you guys remember, just as a quick kind of like space repetition, remember that was that dumbbells mnemonic, right? So that was like, if you kind of go through there, you got diarrhea, you'll have excessive urination, you'll have meiosis, which is the pupil constriction, you'll have bradycardia, you'll have other types of problems such as extreme issues with your central nervous system, so convulsions and also a lot of weakness, right? The other aspect is that you'll have lacrimation, salivation, sweating. I think these are really, really important things to remember. With anticholinergic toxicity, it's just the exact opposite. So go through the CNS. With this, the patients have extreme delirium and confusion. So it's really important to realize that. With the eyes, they're not going to constrict anymore. They're going to dilate. So be careful in that with patients who have narrow angle glaucoma. It could worsen their intraocular pressure. For the lacrimal and the salivary glands, it's going to shut those puppies down. So you're going to end up with the good old dry eyes and dry mouth. For the heart, it's going to, again, speed up the heart rate. And so you may develop a kind of a profound increase in their heart rate and cardiac output to the point where they may even become hypertensive. It also can work on the lungs. So watch for good, the good positive symptoms of this would be bronchodilation. So that might be helpful. I think that's the only good thing. And then for the bladder, again, you don't contract that puppy. So you retain, don't make good urine. And then again, also in the GIT, you're not going to have a lot of GI motility there going. So there is the risk of constipation. And then again, remember, the acetylcholine is released on sweat glands. And so again, if you're not having a lot of acetylcholine being able to bind onto those muscarinic receptors to produce sweat, you'll end up overheating, right? Because you'll have that hyperthermic effect. You won't be able to self-regulate via evaporative cooling from sweating. So that's an important thing to be able to realize. Now, the question is like, Zach, is this only from using muscarinic antagonists? That's one. So any of the medications that we just mentioned, yes, that is a possibility, especially the tertiary amines, the ones that have good CNS penetration. They're really lipophilic. They're good at depositing into a lot of organs. But other drugs that you really want to be careful with are drugs that aren't pure muscarinic antagonists, but have anticholinergic properties. So tricyclic antidepressants actually have anticholinergic properties. Antipsychotics have anticholinergic properties. Antihistamines, especially first generation ones, have a lot of anticholinergic effects. And then they like to ask this one sometimes on your exam. So watch out for the belladonna poison. Some of those leaves and berries of the belladonna plant, if you even know what that looks like or where you can find one, just stay away from it.
I would have no idea.
I know. I would be eating and be like, this is delicious. Later, I'm like hypertensive, tachycardic. Oh man, something's not right. So it's important to remember those big things. But nonetheless, I think the last question or kind of statement here is, patient develops anticholinergic toxicity, you should be able to have an idea of what to give that patient. And I find that really the only true drug that is going to be potentially beneficial in anticholinergic toxicity is physostigmine. So physostigmine is a what? A cholinergic agonist. And so if you guys remember, it inhibited the acetylcholinesterase present in multiple synapses at nicotinic receptors, at muscarinic receptor sites. So it's going to increase the acetylcholine in those sites to hope to be able to beat out the muscarinic antagonist out of that site. And so hopefully you'll improve your delirium, your pupillary dilation, you'll produce more secretions, you'll become not as tachycardic, hypertensive, you won't be constipated, and you won't be retaining urine, and you won't be hyperthermic. So I find that unfortunately, though, physostigmine seems to be the most beneficial only in relation to atropine, but if it's the only thing that you can give them, give it to them. Give them the physostigmine. But that's the things I want you guys to realize. And I think that caps off our discussion here on muscarinic antagonists, Rob.
Alrighty, we've done it. That is autonomic pharmacology. Boom. Roasted four episodes. We're out of here.
But yeah, I really do hope that this series on autonomic pharmacology made sense. I think it is a true kind of basic kind of pharmacological topic that you have to go through as you're kind of introduced into pharmacology. So I really hope it made sense. I hope the cholinergic agonist, antagonist, and then I hope the, you know, the sympathetic or the adrenergic agonist and antagonist makes sense as well. But ninjaners, we thank you. We love you. Thank you for being so supportive on all of our platforms, whether it be YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, our podcasts, and even checking out our website. We just thank you guys for being so awesome, so dedicated, so supportive to this cause. And we're just so thankful, and we'll continue to keep doing the best that we can to make you all proud and hopefully help you guys in your careers. But love you guys. Thank you guys. And as always, until next time.